This program is brought to you by Stanford on iTunes U at Stanford University. Please visit us at itunes.stanford.edu.
We move tonight into the last part of the course, dramatic material, the end of the life of Yeshua and the beginning of the life of Christ. It's going to take us four classes or so to do that. We will tonight set up the framework, finish some material from last week, set up the framework of the death of Yeshua. The book that governs the first parts of our discussion is John Dominic Crossan's Who Killed Jesus. You may want to take a look at an earlier book of which this is a continuation or a reformulation, and that earlier book is called The Cross That Spoke. I'll explain that this evening. And then the last book that we'll look at, we're always kind of gathering the materials as we go on from Paula Fredrickson, from wherever we can, but the last main book will be Stephen Patterson's book on the interpretation of the death of Yeshua, and then into the resurrection. We'll say some things.
Okay. Is that what book we're reading next time?
I beg your pardon?
Sorry, is that what book we're reading
next time? Have you finished Crossan?
No.
All right, we'll go finish Crossan and go to Patterson,
okay.
Whenever you can.
Okay.
All right, let me start this going, if I may. The basic outline of the course, as you know, has been threefold. We spent a lot of time in the beginning just setting the stage for discussion of the historical Jesus, of Yeshua of Nazareth. We spent less time in the middle than I wanted to, on the words and the deeds of Yeshua. And we're moving very quickly this evening through the deeds of Yeshua. I will put up on the site some of the slides you're going to see this evening. It'll take a while to get going. And then you won't have to copy material off of the board. But there's going to be a chart of the so-called miracles of Yeshua, which I will prefer to call the wonders of Yeshua, because that's the word that's used in the scriptures. See if we're doing okay. Could I ask your help with this while oh no, it seems to be coming up. That's okay. It's just taking a while. What we have to finish up then is the deeds of Yeshua and then move on to his death. We're going to be reviewing some of the material that brought us to this point, going into the miracles, and then basically starting a discussion on the death of Yeshua. Turns out that we're going to have even equally, at least, complex problems with the sources in the scriptures on the death of Yeshua, as we had with the life of Yeshua, when we dealt with the parables and tonight with the deeds. Sorry for this figure. We'll get it up in just a second, but I'll feel more comfortable once I have it running. I hope it'll be worth your while once it gets going, but... I really can't do anything until this comes up, so we might as well... yes, please.
The PowerPoint presentation will be on the...
Yes, I'll put it up, I hope, this evening, if I can.
There you go.
Oh, there we go. Thank you. Thank you for telling me that. I don't know if it's the problems with this computer or with the connection, but I'm having some problems here. The slide that we're going to be looking at, as long as we're waiting, is, thank you, from John Meyer's book, A Marginal Jew. It's a four-volume work, of which only three of the volumes have been published. The fourth volume on the death of Yeshua will be published within a year, I guess, from now. The reason why on the question of the wonders of Yeshua, the reason why I rely on John Meyer is because the wonders or miracles have often been used as the knockdown proof that Jesus was the Son of God, that he was demonstrably the Messiah because he could perform not only miracles towards people, but even miracles that showed his control over nature. John Meyer, in the second volume of this immense treatise, and this volume here is 1,000 pages, give or more, give a few more pages, has investigated every one of the 32 reported wonders of Yeshua in the 4 canonical Gospels. He has, in the most exhausting detail, analyzed each one of those miracles for its historicity and its transmission history. What I'm offering you here is simply the conclusions of his work, inviting you to look at Volume 2. It's very clearly written. It's exhaustive, and maybe exhausting. But in any case, what I'll offer you here tonight is simply his conclusions about the miracles. Meyer is on the spectrum of the current consensus, center-right. He's a Catholic scholar, and he's a priest. He is a student of Raymond E. Brown, now deceased, and sort of carries the mantle of Raymond Brown. And both Brown and he always tend to be more conservative, perhaps looking over their shoulder at the tradition of Christian doctrine, as well as at the scriptures themselves. So if Meyer, who is a conservative, is saying very minimal things about the wonders of Yeshua, we can only imagine what other people will say about those wonders or miracles. So I'm choosing a very good, historically based, exegetically astute scholar to talk about the miracles, because some of it is surprising, I think, to those of us who may be looking at this for the first time. First of all, a distinction. 32 reported wonders, or I guess I'll use the word miracle since it seems to be the normal word, in the 4 Gospels, but he draws a ratio. 12 of the 32, 38% only, have a basis in some historical Jesus event. That doesn't mean in a miraculous historical event. The miraculous dimension can be added on later. But nonetheless, only 12 have any basis in history. The others being creations of the evangelists themselves, perhaps drawing upon traditions, perhaps inventing them themselves for their community. That's fairly striking. You know, tonight when we're going to be watching election returns, perhaps late into the evening, 38% is not a good number if you were trying to win the miracles election, as it were. We also should note, as you already know no doubt from your reading, that there were plenty of miracle workers in the Levant at the time, and in Judaism particularly, but not only in Judaism, in Greco-Roman culture as well. Honi the Circle Drawer, whom you read about in the E.P. Sanders article, his review of Paula Fredrickson, was one. Draw the circle, step inside, and make it rain. I actually was a part of a miracle of rainmaking in Mexico in 1962, in which a novena of masses were said during a drought around the area of Taxco. And I was there working, and I actually accompanied the priest, who was reluctant to go out and do this novena of masses, but he'd been requested by the Indians, the natives of the region, because a drought had happened before. And after a certain novena, it rained. This was in July, early August. It wasn't going to rain. So we made the dreary trip each day out to a different village, way up into the hills, into the poorer sections around Taxco. And then the last night of the novena, all of these hundreds of mostly Indians gathered in the cathedral city of Taxco. Many of you know it. It's a gem of a colonial town. And there was a large mass, not a cloud in the sky, a candlelight procession out to a little hill outside town, not a cloud in the sky. And then everybody came back into town. And I was a resident with the priest and his entourage. And we sat there and ate dinner in silence. And then the skies opened, and it rained a torrent at about 9:30 at night. And the next day, the delegation of the Indians who had organized this came to the parish and basically said, well, thanks, we knew it was going to work. And that priest didn't know it was going to work. Pony the circle drawer in contemporary garden. The miracles of Jesus break down into four categories. Three of them directed at human beings, so they're person-to-person miracles. And one category, perhaps the most famous, are nature miracles. That is to say, the object of the miracle, the wonder working, is a change of climate, a change of weather, the calming of a storm, the multiplying of food, things of that nature. Well, beginning with the healings, but starting at the bottom, lepers, ironically, don't seem to have a chance. Zero for two accounts reported. By the way, leprosy in this context means skin disease, as Meyer points out in great detail. So it doesn't mean a withered limb that somehow grows back, but it means terrible or serious skin disease. There are other various healings. I'll list them in just a moment, and it's one-third. Two out of three that have any basis in history, not necessarily a miraculous basis. The lame walking, two out of four, seem to have an historical basis. And the blind seeing, three for three. Perhaps that's easier to envision, excuse the bad pun, it's easier to understand that because of the following. As you know, Crossan and others have made a distinction between cures and healing. You heard him make that distinction regarding Lourdes in South France. Cures are what happened, let us say, at Stanford Hospital. Healings often happen in a psychiatrist's office, in a therapist's office, in a counseling room, or among friends. Healing is a much broader, less a scientific term. Were these healings of Yeshua cures? Did limbs grow back? Did people who were truly blind see? So the miracle would say. But if you look closely at them, and again I refer you to Meyer's book, lots of times, especially in John, the sight is often metaphorical. I didn't see, now I see. So perhaps the blind seeing is batting 3 for 3, 100, because of those possible metaphoric means. In anything, exorcisms, 2 out of 7. What's an exorcism? Today, in the Roman Catholic Church, as allegedly back then, it's the driving out of demons that possess the inner life of a person. Well, let's leave aside the Catholic tradition, let's leave aside the ancient tradition of possession by demons, because demons are part of the stage props of an apocalyptic framework. In the apocalyptic framework, not only are we looking forward to an inbreak at the end of time, but there's also communication between the two realms, really the three, the heavens, the earth, and under the earth. So the visionaries are brought up into heaven. Paul claims to have had a vision, brought up to the third heaven, whether in the body or out of the body, I don't know, he says. That's an apocalyptic scenario. Those things seem to happen a lot to people. Likewise, since we're dealing in this age with a battle between the forces of dark and light, devil and Yahweh, good and evil, of course devils would occupy someone's inner life, take them over and speak through their mouths and make them do all sorts of wild things. Now, that's the framework of interpretation within which that works. Perhaps it doesn't work today at Harvard Medical School or at the psychiatric ward here at Stanford. So, exorcisms, 2 out of 7, we'll see what those cases are. Third, raising the dead. There we have to make another very important religious or theological distinction, 1 out of the 3 cases. Make a distinction between raising the dead and, I'll always use this word in quotes, resurrection, that which happened to Yeshua after his death and will happen to all human beings who follow him at the end of time. Raising from the dead doesn't mean that the person lives on forever afterwards. It means the person comes back to life. It's erroneous but common for Christians to use that language of come back to life in application to Yeshua's resurrection. Raising the dead can take place in many ways, but the point is that once that person is risen, he or she still has to pay her taxes, still has to eventually die. So death and taxes are visited anew upon the person raised from the dead. That isn't the case in the resurrection of Jesus and the resurrection of Christian believers, which is the eschatological moment or the apocalyptic moment that is being looked forward to. Please.
So then, are you comparing resuscitation with resurrection?
Resuscitation is one form of raising of the dead. Resurrection, absolutely distinct. Josephus, for example, the Jewish historian writing in the 90s, who saw a lot of terror during the Jewish war, right, and finally goes over to the Roman side, becomes their Flavian historian, right, the house of Flavius, adopts him in effect. He mentions, of course, there were scores of crucifixions following various revolts. Thousands of people were crucified. It's very interesting that we only have one skeleton of a crucified person, despite the fact that thousands were crucified. What conclusion do you draw from that? That they went to heaven? That what? They were left on the cross or taken down and thrown into a lime pit. That's where you don't find many bones anymore. If they were properly buried, which would have been unusual for the Romans to allow criminals to receive a proper burial, if they were properly buried, we'd have more ossuaries at least, not necessarily bones in a tomb, but the bones were collected and put in a little box, right, and buried properly inside the, or in the floor sometimes, of tombs, right, so that you could use the tomb many times. No, there are very few signs of that. But in any case, back to Josephus, he once petitioned to have a friend of his taken down from the cross, and the guy survived. For how much time, I don't know, but at least for a few days. In other words, it was possible, in this case after the torture of the cross, but not yet the demise of the victim, to have the Roman authorities allow you to take that body down and allow you to do what you can, perhaps, to resuscitate it. So resuscitation, apparent death or close to death, near-death experiences, are not resurrections in the proper sense of the term, in which it's used as a theological, eschatological, if you will, end time, but not in an apocalyptic sense, meaning. Right? One out of three, so we'll see those in a moment. And then finally, nature miracles. Sadly, only one out of seven, and turning water into wine is not one of the one out of seven, unfortunately. Thomas Aquinas, in the 13th century, in his good Italian Neapolitan humor, pointed out that the nice thing about the miracle at Cana, water into wine, is not that Jesus changed water into wine, but that he changed water into more wine, which I think touched his Italian soul. So let's break this down. And again, please, you needn't copy down the text, the verses, etc., but simply to give you an idea of where you will look, and you'll find all of this and be able to refer to these passages. You'll find this on the coursework site. Healings, 7 out of 15, so just under 50%. The blind see, the lame walk. There are various healings of, that can't be gathered together, and lepers are cleansed. So the best shot is the blind seeing. An asterisk and a sort of a greenish color indicates that it's a go, that it has some historical base. Now, Meyer will not solve for you what that historical base was, but he'll gather the evidence that would give indication that Yeshua did something, for example, in the multiplication of the loaves. Now, it's easy to understand how that story would be turned into a miraculous event, whereas it might have been a communal feeding of the people, a communal meal, right, in which people were satisfied and more than satisfied. So three blind people see. And in John 9, the third of those, the man born blind, it's almost certain that it's being treated as I didn't see before and now I see. You know, I didn't get it and now I get it. The lame walk, paralytic man let down through the roof, the famous iconography of that. The paralytic at Bethesda. Various healings, the deaf mute, the official's servant or son. Notice that Peter's mother-in-law, who is healed early in Mark's gospel, as you know, doesn't count as having an historical basis. Lepers cleansed, neither in Galilee nor the 10 lepers, a kind of a certain symbolic number, don't count. So please, I can't right now fill you in on these details, and if you ask me, I wouldn't be able to because I don't have the documentation in front of me. Exorcisms, driving out demons. Now, of course, that's always problematic, especially if you drive the demons into a herd of pigs and they jump off a cliff, as is reported. Who then pays the farmer or the pig herder for those? An epileptic boy, epilepsy. We don't have a medical diagnosis that that was what the young lad suffered from, but there was some sort of healing that went on there. And of course, Mary Magdalene, out of whom were driven seven devils, not six, not eight. This is the number for full completion, 4 + 3, male plus female equals 7. Well, that could include many things. Mary Magdalene is often without basis depicted as a prostitute. We don't know that to be the case. However, what if she was a woman with a certain unhappy history that are referred to as her seven demons or seven devils, who is then integrated back into the community by Yeshua, and in fact becomes a major player among those women who accompany Yeshua all over Galilee and down to Jerusalem, and a major player in what is reported as the first appearance after the death and resurrection of Yeshua, and so on. But I want to say something about that healing thing, and perhaps you have similar experiences as this. My only foreign experiences besides Latin America have been in Italy, where I've lived for a good number of years. I know village life as well as city life there, I think. Part of my family is from there. And in Piazza Santa Maria in Trastevere, if any of you have been there downtown, but any piazza that is sort of what we call popolare, where the people really hang out, and it's often lower class areas, right? It's quite common to find, excuse this term, it is not meant in a derogatory sense, it's just simply to kind of locate the point, the village idiot, a poor man or woman who doesn't have their life together. But instead of being confined to an asylum, as is so often the case in our country, that person is kept at home, is looked after by other people in the piazza. I've seen him, they light his cigarettes, they humor him, they listen to his jokes, they buy him a coffee or a drink. He has a place within the community. He's not excluded, he's not ostracized. It's very interesting to see how that works. I remember noticing it, especially in the late 70s, when in California, they were expelling people, if you recall, under Governor Reagan from insane asylums. And of course, these people were gathering at laundromats, wherever it was warm, wherever there was some sort of motion that could keep them occupied. It was a very sad situation here in California. It was at that very time that I began to notice how people were integrated into village culture, piazza culture in Italy. I don't know what the situation is now, I really don't. But it's a different way of healing. That person isn't cured. They don't walk away with their wiring all set back in place. One wonders whether the epilepsy, the exclusion of Mary Magdalene, was a healing of socialization, of bringing them back into the community. These are merely guesses, merely thoughts about those rather than anything like proof. Raising from the dead. Let's start with number 3, Lazarus. This is in John's Gospel. His resurrection takes place 4 days after he died. Yeshua intentionally, according to John, delays his visit to Bethany, to his dear friends, Martha and Mary. They had hoped that he would come while he was ill and rescue him from his illness, but no, he waits until he's dead and more than dead. 3 days is dead, 4 days is really dead. Perhaps there is some reference, proleptically, to the 3 days that Yeshua allegedly is in a tomb. In any case, Yeshua calls him forth. They say, don't go near the tomb, it really stinks. 4 days, you know what that's like. Lazarus, come forth. And he comes forth somehow in his swaddling clothes. How he walks out, we don't know. But he then becomes a village spectacle. People come from Jerusalem to have dinner and watch Lazarus eat. Is he resurrected? Not at all, in the sense in which apocalyptic resurrection is described. He has to die again. Legend has him and Mary Magdalene getting on a boat and going to the south of France, and he dies in France somewhere. The son of the widow of Nain. It may have some basis, but since it's unsure, Meyer gives it a kind of a question mark, asterisk. It's only the daughter of Jairus. He goes into the house of Jairus, and he says in Aramaic, that gives it some sort of a historical basis. Talitha, Kumi, young maiden, awake. And she awakens. Whether she was resuscitated, whether she was in a coma, whether she was really dead and brought back to life, who knows? I myself have had maybe some of you have had a near-death experience. I remember when I was I think I was 22, it was just before that trip to Mexico, where I guess I was surrounded by miracles, and I didn't realize that I'm allergic to penicillin. And in order to deal with a boil that I had in my ear, I was working with farm workers, we were unionizing them at that time, I got a very bad infection in the ear, and I told the doctor, please do not lance it, because I have to be out in the fields again, I don't want dirt to get it. He says, not a problem, I'll just give you a shot, you'll be fine. Zack! Or actually, zack! And the shot was penicillin. Now I know I'm allergic to it. Boom! Immediately I just collapsed and lay on his, whatever you call it, his examination table. And I could feel this heavy weight. I thought it was really pounds of cement on my chest. Of course, I was stopping breathing, is what it was about. And then I began to hear knocking in my ear. You know, I was so furious. I said, you know, in my paranoia, that doctor boy was going to talk to my lawyers if I had a lawyer. You know, he's probably given me a shot because I'm out of town. I'm from San Francisco. This was up in Tracy. You know, and so he's going to lance that boil without my permission. That was my paranoid story to myself. My eyes were closed. I couldn't open them. I couldn't move. My mouth was frozen. And at a certain point, Dr. Smith or whoever he was opened my eyes and looked in. I'm seeing it from down here, and I see the panic in his eyes. And he's speaking like a record that's going too fast. I'll be all right. And at that point, I realized he doesn't know what's going on. Boy, am I in. And at that point, I started to spin noises and sounds. And I spun down, and I hit the ground. And it was, just as they promise you, a tunnel, a dark tunnel leading towards the light. And I walked down that tunnel, and I walked out into a garden that was like a Rousseau painting, you know, where the leaves are much bigger than you, and they're, I guess, strange animals or something. I don't know, but I just remember this overwhelmingly beautiful paradisal garden. And a voiceover in this movie quoted a line from a poem that I was reading at the time and very much liked. It's Andrew Marvel's poem. I think it's called The Garden. The last lines of which were perfect for this experience. It all ends in a green shade in a green garden. Next thing I'm awake and the doctor has shot me up with something else. Are you okay? You know, so that was my coming back to life, for which I'm very grateful. And I've never taken penicillin again. And I never got hustled, I was young, I didn't know what I was doing, hustled out of that doctor's office, so you'll be fine, don't worry, you know, and he got me out before I could say what happened. Excuse me.
Now, did you figure out whether you were in a state of grace when this happened?
That's important, right? Well, that was quite a dramatic experience. It took me a while to overcome. In any case, not interesting. Nature miracles, only feeding the multitude, and doesn't that seem to fit the portrait of Yeshua as the open commensality, as we call it? That the outcasts are brought to the table, itself a form of healing. So the nature miracles aren't zap miracles. I can make rain fall when there's drought, or I can, you know, hit somebody with a bolt of lightning if I don't like them. Even the nature miracles are part of the human message and mission of Yeshua. Okay, there's so much we could say about this. I'll refer you to that and other texts that deal with it, but I think that you know, if we have some discussion about this, by all means. Otherwise, we'll take this breath and, in a sense, leave behind the life of Yeshua and move to his death and eventually his resurrection. Is there any comments or any wisdom on this? I don't have too much more to add, but we'd be happy to entertain any discussion that you might have. Okay, here we go. The Passion Narratives, one of the great debates, but just as debated, if you will, as is the life of Yeshua. We have Passion Narratives in all four Gospels, and they all take the same structural form. There will be differences of content here and there. The structural form I abbreviate as CATAEB, just to save some print. He's accused of a crime. He's arrested. He undergoes a trial and is abused. In fact, he undergoes two trials, and they're perfectly parallel, or roughly parallel to each other. He's tried and he's abused by the Jewish Sanhedrin, which is a lay council under the direction of the high priest, Caiaphas. And then he's tried and abused by the Roman authorities. There he's scourged and crowned with thorns. He's then buried, and none of that makes any sense without a resurrection story. Again, I can't keep making those quote signs, but you know that I will contest that word strongly. That's the general structural form that you find in all four Gospels. What is the origin of that common passion narrative with uncommon resurrection stories at the end? It seems that we could divide it between the first five moments and the last moment. We call those passion and this resurrection. It's precisely at the resurrection that the stories go in their different directions. They go haywire. But up to the burial, they all seem to follow the same structural form. Now, there's going to be differences. John's dating will differ radically from the synoptic's dating. If you look at my book on the web, you'll find a chart there that indicates exactly how they differ. Let's review source criticism about his life. Again, the word criticism, as you know, doesn't mean negative carping. Criticism just means scientific judgment, a critique based on evidence, hypothesis, verification, and judgment findings. So when we say source criticism, what's the science of the sources that produce the stories of his life? Well, this is just a review. We saw that Mark is reproduced 90%. 90% of Mark is reproduced by Matthew and 50% by Luke. So we trace those parts back to a written source, Mark. Why written? Because of the exactitude of the quotation. We find that there's an overlap between Matthew and Luke, again, verbally very close, which we trace back to another source. It's called hypothetical, but it's a very strong hypothesis, which is that there was a common source of sayings that Matthew and Luke picked up. And finally, there is the special yellow material of Matthew and green material of Luke. And the importance of sources is that they are not written by individuals sitting in his, her study. They are the expressions of communities. That's very important. It's not simply a one-person edition. Luke, whoever he was, the name is given traditionally, but we don't know who the author of Luke's Gospel, as we call it, was. The Q sources, whether they be at their basic form of wisdom sayings, as the Gospel of Thomas, or in its apocalyptic and threat sayings, or in its final historicizing redaction, putting in his baptism, his temptation, etc., is a community of people. The general agreement is that the Q community and the Thomas community begin as Galileans, therefore as rural people, and they begin as oral traditions. Most of the people couldn't write. They were illiterate, but they weren't stupid. They had very good memories. They had very good abilities of repeating. The same way, if you go back into your own family, at least in mine, the Irish tradition remembers all sorts of things. You wish they'd forget some of those things. But the definition of Irish Alzheimer's is where you forget everything except your grudges. And indeed, the Irish are famous for keeping them. So there are, but also the way the stories are told, there are three people. You know, there were four events, etc., are easy enough to remember. It's like our, you know, do you know the one about the rabbi, the priest, and the minister who go into the bar?
Was there some of the commonality with Thomas and Luke?
It's more Thomas and original Q. In fact, there are, I'm gonna miss this by one or two, I think. There are either 34 or 37 common sayings to Q and to Thomas. Now, Q will be picked up by Luke, to be sure. But that common, that commonality makes one think, this is again Crossan's hypothesis, which I think is good, that off the chart here on the left, there is a common saying source, not as a text, a written text, but as a circulating oral tradition. Why not a text? Because we don't have verbal citations. But there's a commonality between the wisdom in Thomas and Q. And I think it's Clausen, maybe it's someone else, has taken those commonalities, those overlaps, put them together, the 37 verses of wisdom, and published it, I think, as the real gospel of Jesus or the authentic gospel of Jesus, etc. Meaning, that's as close as we can get to Joshua. But these two communities, one of which will eventually become Gnostic, one of which will eventually become apocalyptic, but not in its origins, right? These two communities are as far back as we can get to the historical Yeshua. From this point out, we use those 3, 4, 5 criteria to establish what we think is the minimum of the historical Yeshua. There is going to be a similar source issue with the death resurrection. I'm going to draw now on the board a chart that in many ways we've used before, seen before. Or can you all see this part of the blackboard if I open it out? We've distinguished, I believe, three meanings of the word history. History itself is an ambiguous word. It can refer to events or to the writing of events. If it's the writing of events, we call it historiography. But if historiography is the interpretation of those events, we usually think of it as an interpretation written by scholars. But no, historiography happens in your own family. When you finally tell your children the story about Uncle Vince, it's my Uncle Vince, there's lots of stories to be told there. And what did it mean that Uncle Vince was such a rogue? How do we deal with that? This is the interpretative framework. Right? This is the frame of reference within which those events get, we would say nowadays, spun or interpreted. Right? But the more important, most important is what I call the historic. Do those events, one history, we're actually referring to events themselves that are historic, right? They will get interpreted and spun, and then they will either be historic or not. So anyway, I just want to distinguish various meanings of the word history. Over here, the historic can be either professionally, scholarly, academically historic,